Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 27, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking to do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two interviews lined up for tonight, both of them pre-recorded. One recorded earlier today with Pratap Chatterjee, who is the director of the CorpWatch website, corpwatch.org, and author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, but it's just more of the same, called Iraq Inc., about who's making money off contracts on the destruction and reconstruction, or the failed reconstruction of Iraq. He's just back from Iraq, and we'll talk to him about all this in a few minutes. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview recorded yesterday with Andrew Ross, who is the professor of American Studies at New York University and author of the book Fast Boat to China, which is the product of the year he spent living in Shanghai investigating the offshore information technology jobs in China, in the new China. And before to do a few economic headlines in a little bit, but a couple of announcements first. Number one, one of my guests last week, Jose Vasquez, who is the president of the New York City chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War, mentioned tomorrow's Speak Out Against the War, sponsored by that organization, featuring combat vets and conscientious objectors, in case you have forgotten that. It's worth a reminder. Friday, tomorrow night, 5 to 7 p.m., the Community Church, 450 East 35th Street, between Madison Park and Manhattan. That is a Speak Out with Iraq vets and conscientious objectors. Tomorrow, 5 to 7 p.m., the Community Church, 40 East 35th Street, Manhattan. And then next week, a week from today, 4:30 p.m., Thursday, May 4th, Kathleen Cleaver, former communications secretary of the Black Panther Party and currently a professor at Emory and Yale Universities, will be speaking at Brooklyn College. The title of her talk is Behind the Myths, Rosa Parks and America's Struggle for Human Rights. This will be at the Bedford Lounge of the Brooklyn College Student Center, Campus Road and East 27th Street, Brooklyn College. And then finally, my first guest, who we'll hear from in a little bit, Pratap Chatterjee, will be reading tonight at Blue Stockings Bookstore, 172 Allen Street, between Stanton and Rivington, one block south of the intersection of Houston Street and First Avenue, at 7 p.m. And just a quick look at some of the economic headlines. This morning, the Labor Department reporting that jobless claims, the weekly tally of people who lost their jobs, head over to the Unemployment Insurance Office to sign up for benefits. That sensitive indicator of the state of the job market up 11,000 last week, kind of a surprise strength in, of course, strength being a bad bit of bad news in that indicator, and also the four-week moving average, which smooths out some of the week-to-week noise in that series, also rising a bit. So it does look like the jobless claims numbers peaked out in late January, or bottomed out, rather, in late January, have been working their way higher ever since, suggesting that maybe the job market is reaching the end of its rope. The Federal Reserve's Beige Book, which is a report prepared just before its policymaking meetings by the various regional branches of the Federal Reserve, reporting solid economic activity throughout the country. All 12 Federal Reserve districts reporting that economic activity expanded in the 6 weeks ending in mid-April. They say residential construction is said to be moderating in many districts, while commercial building is firming. Speaking of residential construction, some surprising strength in the house sales numbers. First of all, the National Association of Realtors report on sales of existing houses up a surprising 200,000 last month. This number is just refusing to roll over. It has come down from its peak a year ago, but it did look like it was falling down for a few months, but now it has picked up a little bit. Similar with the new house sales, which is reported by the Census Bureau every month, that up also about 200,000 and recovering smartly from the declines in the previous 2 months. And again, it looks like the housing market has peaked, but is not yet rolling over and playing dead. The Mortgage Bankers Association, however, reporting that new applications for mortgages fell last week and continuing a downtrend in that measure that began last summer. So that does suggest that the housing market has passed its peak, but it's not yet falling apart. And this is, of course, very important. Housing has been one of the driving forces in the U.S. economy over the last couple of years. ABC News, Washington Post weekly poll of consumer attitudes finally taking a big hit, off 4 points last week to minus 11 after rising in earlier weeks. And this is almost certainly the result of higher gasoline prices, now around $3 a gallon. Also, with gasoline prices rising, I can predict with some confidence that George Bush's approval ratings will be falling because they are very closely tied. Unlike previous presidents, by the way, but George Bush's approval rating has been almost a perfect mirror image of the price of gas. And then finally, in congressional testimony earlier today, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke said that U.S. economic growth will be moderating later this year, but that high energy prices remain a risk to both inflation and economic activity. The markets have been thinking that the Federal Reserve is going to end its round of tightening next when it meets in a few weeks. But Bernanke sort of disabusing them of that. He said a pause does, they may pause after their May meeting, May 10th meeting, but that doesn't mean an end, and it will all depend upon how the data come in. It's my suspicion that the Federal Reserve thinks that the economy is just a bit too strong. Wages are going to rise and prices will continue to rise, and they don't like it that way. So my suspicion is they're going to turn towards the hawkish side, perhaps more than Wall Street expects, but I don't make as much money as they do, so maybe they know more than I do. Anyway, let's take a little musical break, and we'll be listening to an interview recorded earlier today with Pranab Chatterjee.
We are sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we save to keep the wealthy back. Think of corruption and ruin in the land. Crooked politicians betray the working man. Pockets in the process and treating us like sheep. We're tired of hearing politics and all the narrative. Money and corruption.
Money and Corruption from the Kinks, 1973, and it's Money and Corruption ruining not only this land, but the land of Iraq, which has had to cope not only with the destructive power of the U.S. military, but the failed reconstruction offered by the U.S. Government. And Pratap Chatterjee, who is the director of the website CorpWatch, corpwatch.org, and author of the book Iraq, Inc., just back from a trip to that country, reports on what he found. Interview recorded earlier today, and it just emerging this morning in the Washington Post that the Congressional Research Service estimates that the cost of the Iraq war will total $320 billion by the end of the year. Remarkable number. Okay, Pratap Chatterjee. The U.S. is spending a ton of money in Iraq. Who's making money off all that spending?
Well, the only people that are profiting out of this occupation are the companies that are doing reconstruction, the companies that are providing support to the military logistics, people like Halliburton. It is certainly not us, the taxpayer, who are expecting something in return for our dollars, and it is most certainly not the Iraqi people who are hoping to see hospitals and schools and democracy. None of that is happening. And in Iraq, Inc., what I do is I look at the business of contracting in Iraq from the point of view of a business journalist, which, in fact, is my past. I once upon a time wrote for the Financial Times. And to me, I think it's interesting, rather than looking at things politically or militarily, is to just look at industry sectors. And so I've divided in Iraq, Inc., the businesses in Iraq into four sectors. Military logistics, and that really we're talking about Halliburton. This is the company that is doing all the support for the troops. They cook the food, they clean the toilets, they deliver the mail, they deliver the fuel, or they did at one point. They do everything the military needs. And the day Halliburton stops working, the occupation is over. They are the backbone of the occupation, of the military side of the occupation.
How much of that depends upon the fact that Dick Cheney used to be their chairman, and how much is just that Halliburton does stuff that other people don't?
Well, a lot of it has to do with Dick Cheney, not entirely. Halliburton does do things that other people don't, in the sense that they have had a monopoly on the business of supporting government in war over the last 12 years. So nobody has as much experience as Halliburton, because nobody else has gotten a chance to get their hands on the contracts, except DynCorp, which is another big contract. And in fact, even when they had the main contract in supporting the U.S. military, they subcontracted to Halliburton. So they've run this, you know, as a monopoly since this business of subcontracting military logistics started, which is back in around 1992 or so. It's about 14 years ago. Now, having said that, there are many people that can do this kind of work. All engineering contracting companies hire 1,000 people, you know, at a moment's notice, send them in to build a dam, build a road, build a bridge, build a nuclear power plant, and then demobilize them, you know, 5 months later. So what Halliburton is doing, other people could have done. However, maybe other people haven't worked as closely with the military as let's say, Bechtel. I mean, Halliburton has worked much more closely than Bechtel has or somebody else. But on this scale, the only people who can really do it are military engineering contractors. Now, you can beg the question, should there be an occupation? Should there be, you know, people cooking food for soldiers? And should all the money, and remember, most of the money, and here we're talking 90% of the money or more of the money that's spent in Iraq is spent on American soldiers, not on Iraqi people. Most Iraqis don't have jobs. You know, the unemployment in certain places is as high as 60 or 70%. So if you want to fix a country and you're spending 10 times more money on supporting a military occupation that does nothing for the people, especially since they're not actually safe from suicide bomb attacks and things like that, you're wasting your money and you're angering the local people. But you get back to the four sectors. You have the military logistics people like Halliburton. You have the reconstruction people like Bechtel and Parsons, who are supposedly building the hospitals and schools and things like that. Then you have the private security people, the men with guns who drive around and shoot at anybody who comes anywhere close to the engineers they're guarding or the government officials they're guarding. And then finally you have the sort of the government advisors, the government consultants. So in the book I call them shadow government. And I don't mean that in any kind of conspiracy kind of way, but they're the ones who are there making sure that government happens. And since oftentimes these are the same people who do work for the CIA and the NSA, these are people who are not accustomed to working in a transparent way and don't really know how to do democratic work. So despite the fact that they have the contract to run or have the contract to constitute the Iraqi government, these companies have done a really, really bad job. And they're very good examples of that. For example, the company that was in charge of putting together Iraq's government was a company from San Diego called Science Application International Corporation, SAIC. They're also the company that create the software to monitor your voicemail and your email. They do most of their work for the CIA and the NSA. So they were sent to run government. They were also sent to run a television station to educate the Iraqi people on democracy and to tell them what a wonderful job the American government is doing. Now, the problem is they've never run a television station before. The closest they've come to is running the security cameras for the Olympics. They've done a lot of psychological warfare on behalf of the U.S. military, but they've never actually had to interact with real people and real arbitrons and real television audiences. So they got a lot of money. They got $15 million to run this television station. They spent over $80 million, which I'm not that good at math, but as far as I can tell, it's more than they were budgeted to spend. And at the end of it, they had less than a 10% share. So forget about a conspiracy. From the point of view of selling your program to the public, nobody's watching them. I walked into their offices a few times a couple of years ago, and what were the people who ran the station watching? Well, they were watching Al Jazeera, which is what everybody else watches. So these people did a spectacularly bad job of running government. The CPA was in charge of giving away money, and so they hired a private government to go run Iraq. And the private government was run by hired by a tribe in western Montana. And these people
hired an Indian tribe.
A Native American tribe.
Why?
Well, it's just the way contracting is done. Contracting is done in such a way to give best opportunity to minorities. I mean, that's one of the rules that, you know, we've incorporated into the way the government does business. And it's a good thing on the face of it. Actually, a lot of Alaskan tribes and Montana tribes take jobs that other people want to have kept secret. They do a lot of military contracts, they do a lot of intelligence contracts. But the great thing about hiring a tribe is because they're a tribe, you can give them a no-bid contract because, you know, they're a minority. And so the intelligence people and people who run military bases realize that this is an easy way to get jobs past the public. And so they hand them black contracts and deep black contracts and contracts they don't want scrutiny over. And then the tribes do whatever they want. They may then rehire the big multinationals. So you'll sometimes have an Alaskan tribe hiring Lockheed to do a job, and the tribe has no experience in it. But Lockheed has a really good experience in doing military work and ripping off the government. And so that's how things work, and that's what happened with the CPA. The CPA hired this tribe in western Montana, asked them to hire people to give away money. They had a guy called Robert Stein. And Robert Stein shows up, he's in charge of $82 million, has the ability to sign checks of up to $500,000, and he calls up a friend in Romania, has a friend bid on contracts, gives him 11 contracts, so this is, what is that, $5.5 million. And then with that, the two friends, Robert Stein and his friend, whose name escapes me, Phil Bloom is his name, they buy machine guns and grenade launchers, they have a villa full of women, they buy a Lexus, they buy a Porsche, they buy a Cessna aircraft, they buy a whole bunch of watches, they buy property in North Carolina, which is where Robert Stein is from. And it turns out that our man Robert Stein was in fact a credit card felon, and the tribe when they hired him hadn't checked his background. I would not say that this was a plan and part of either the tribe or the U.S. government to rip off the Iraqi people, but it was so disorganized and all the money was so badly accounted for, this man realized, took advantage of it, and as have many other people, and they have ripped off both the Iraqi people and Iraqi oil money and the American taxpayer, and done a spectacularly bad job in reconstructing Iraq.
Well, speaking of that spectacularly bad job, and the question of plan versus incompetence or disorganization, which is it? I mean, we look at, you know, they've had 3 years now, and the reconstruction has barely happened. The administration likes to point to a school they built here and there, but, you know, really, immense amounts of money have gone down a rat hole. You would think that something could have been done. Why has so little been done, and why has so much money been spent doing so little?
Well, let me give you an example. I was in northern Iraq last week, and I went up to the Iranian border to a town called Penjwin. And the reason I went there was the U.S. military published an article in one of their newspapers saying, the media always tells you about the bad side of things, you know. Let us give you some examples of successes. This school that we rebuilt, you know, before we came to the school, people were afraid of foreigners coming from out of town. Now they welcome them because they're so happy that we built this boys' dormitory. I didn't think there was much point going there because I figured this is one of their showcase things and I wasn't going to learn a lot from it. But the head of engineering for the education department in Soleimani, the capital of that part of Iraq, said, you really should go take a look at it. So, I mean, this was their show school, the one that they boasted about as being an example of what the media was not reporting on, the fact that reconstruction was proceeding smoothly. So I get to Penjwin. It's a couple of hours' drive from Soleimani. You actually end up driving through minefield to get there. It's incredibly beautiful, right on the border, up high in the mountains in Iran, and you get to the boys' dormitory. And it's freshly painted yellow and red, and you get it walking through the front gate, and you walk around the back, and the back isn't painted, and there's debris in the back. Then you walk upstairs and you turn on the taps of water. And the students took us around and there's no water in the taps because they haven't connected the water system.
Can't even build a Potemkin village.
They can't even build a Potemkin village, literally. And you walk around the side and the sewage is spilling out on the east side of the building. Now, here's an interesting contrast. The company that was in charge of that is a company from Burlingame in California called ECCI. I drove about an hour and a half from there to a place called Dokan Lake. And right there, the U.S. has built a new prison. You've heard of Abu Ghraib. This is the fourth largest prison in Iraq after Abu Ghraib, Camp Crap, and Camp Bucca is Fort Susay. Same company built that prison. I tried to get in there to see if the water worked upstairs, and they wouldn't let me in. I said, look, hey, I'm from the Bay Area. I'm interested in this company. I just checked out one of the schools, and I heard they built this prison. There were two American soldiers with no identifying signs on their uniforms and heavily armed, and they said to me, sorry, you can't come in. And I said, why not? And who are you anyway? Are you 101st Airborne or 10th Mountain Division? They're like, sorry, we can't tell you. So here's his contracts. A lot of these contracts of reconstruction, even the ones the U.S. military boasts about, have been really badly done. And since the reporters don't get out and check things out because they're either afraid or incompetent, nobody realizes most of these quote-unquote success stories are in fact disasters. But when those very same companies work for the military they do a good job. And so here's the question. Did the American administration want to really rebuild these things? Did they care about it? Are these companies accountable? And you can look, you know, you can go down the list and you will see the same companies that have failed to fix the hospitals. I had with me a bottle of water. This bottle of water is from a town called Halabja. And Halabja is one of the reasons we went to war. We went to war because Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons to bomb the people of Halabja. Now, the people of Halabja, this is almost 20 years ago, you know, most of them don't have proper drinking water. And the water that I have here is from a spring that's above the town of Halabja. And that drinking water could be piped. It's about a couple of miles. Could be piped into the city. And the U.S. government promised they would build a $10 million water supply plant to provide them with water. But they ran out of money because they were so busy spending the money on the war, on the military, and spending on building a new fortified U.S. embassy in Baghdad, that they canceled the project. So when I got there and I went to look at the water system, you know, people said, so we hope you're not leaving. And we're like, what do you mean? We're like, yeah, we were just here to look at the water plant. The last people who came promised us a road. Are you going to walk away without fixing the water plant? We're like, whoa, wait a moment. We're just journalists. We're here to report on the fact that you haven't got. But people were like, what's going on? Why do the Americans leave? Why do they promise all this stuff? Why? And then a lot of more skeptical people were like, I mean, do they just steal our money? How come we don't even have gasoline? How come we have to smuggle our gasoline from Iran? That's what Iraqis do today. If you want gasoline, it is smuggled over the mountains by donkey and then sold in jerrycans by the roadside because Iraq doesn't have enough gasoline for its people. That's the situation today.
I'm speaking with Pratap Chatterjee, who is the author of Iraq, Inc., and executive director of CorpWatch. Well, that brings up another question. We can understand, almost understand, for very cynical imperialist reasons, why the United States would not want to rebuild schools and water supplies. But the oil industry, why can't they get that running again? You would think they have a deep interest to pay for the occupation, and also because of the intimate relations between the Bush administration and the oil industry, why can't they get Iraqi oil flowing again?
Well, this is an incredibly puzzling question, and once again, I think they don't really care about Iraq. To them, it's geostrategic. It's about setting up bases more than about the oil industry, and I think that's where a lot of people make a mistake. They assume we went to Iraq to steal their oil. Now, we were getting their oil in the first place because Saddam Hussein was actually selling gasoline to the United States through other companies and that sort of thing. We went there because this is a vital place, and we needed to have military bases there. But since the Iraqis control their own oil and sell it, we weren't really going to interfere in the business of selling it. So we hired Halliburton. We told Halliburton, go fix the oil industry. Now, this is what's most puzzling, and which makes me really believe this whole thing is more incompetence than conspiracy, is Halliburton is actually the best company in the world for fixing pipelines. They invented the technologies for drilling, you know. So if anybody can fix a pipeline, they can. You know, if anybody can drill for oil, they can. They don't drill for oil themselves, but they build, you know, half of the refining and pipeline and drilling capacity in the world. Well, maybe the numbers isn't exactly accurate, but they are the biggest supplier of services to the oil industry in the world. They were asked to fix the oil pipelines there, and they did a really bad job, partly because they were following orders of the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Army Corps of Engineers said, let's build, and the New York Times actually had a story on this 2 days ago, and it's only part of the story the New York Times has. The LA Times, 6 months ago, had a much more complex and interesting story looking at three areas, not the one area the Times is looking at, where Halliburton has done a really bad job because of its collaboration with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Now, once again, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is very good at building dams, or well, maybe not that good at building dams. They're building spectacularly useless and environmentally destructive dams in the United States. But at least
can move earth and pour concrete.
They can move earth and they can pour concrete, but they know nothing about the oil industry. So they were asked to hire Halliburton to go fix the pipeline. So their idea was build pipelines under the river so they won't be destroyed. Now, remember, those pipelines were destroyed actually by the United States when they bombed the bridge. This is the Al-Fatah Bridge, and it carries oil from Kirkuk, one of the biggest oil-producing fields in the north, to Beji, the refinery. So the Army said, let's rebuild those pipelines. We don't build it above land because it might get bombed again by somebody else or blown up. Let's build them under the river. But they never really studied the river. And so the river bed was notoriously unstable, and so the pipelines broke. And so as a result today, Iraq has on an estimate a loss of $8 billion in possible income from the bad repair of these pipelines that Halliburton did. Their refusal to fix oil producing wells because they weren't given insurance, political risk insurance. And finally, their disastrous fixing of the water treatment plants in the south that helped maintain the pressure in the oil fields in Rumaila, which is one of the southern oil fields. So Iraq's oil industry is in a shambles, and partly it's Halliburton's fault, and partly it's the military's fault. However, at the same time, and because of that, because little oil is being produced, and then, of course, you have the security situation, the sabotage, etc. So there's very little oil being produced, even less being refined, because Iraq never had a high refinery system in the first place. But at the same time, because there's free trade and anybody can buy whatever they want, the rich people have bought lots of cars, so they need a lot of gasoline. And because the subsidies that we've continued from Saddam Hussein's time, everybody drives and buys gasoline. So there's a huge shortage of gasoline, and there's no supply. So in the face of it, when you look at the confluence of free trade policies, subsidies, the military contracting process, the failure to be accountable and transparent, at the end of it, Iraqis have no gasoline, and they have to import that gasoline from Turkey, which has stopped supplying it because they owe them $1 billion because they have no cash, from Kuwait, which continues to supply it, and ordinary people basically buy smuggled gasoline that's smuggled up the mountains from Iran.
This is a country with some of the largest oil reserves in the world. We only have a minute or so left, but there's no doubt that there is the technical competence to get these jobs done. Halliburton could do it. They do it elsewhere. Certainly the United States has the technical capacity to build schools and hospitals and water supply systems. We've got them in our country, so there's no reason we couldn't build them in Iraq. Why? You know, is it a conspiracy? Is there some deliberate policy decision behind this? Or really, is it a massive failure of planning?
I think it is a massive failure of planning. And the conspiracy is that they simply don't care. They are really not interested in the Iraqi people. To them, what's important is a military show of force, the shock and awe, the presence in the Gulf region, proving to the American people that they should re-elect Bush because they are tough and on terror. I mean, it's, you know, a creation of a bogey. So that's the reason they went to war. That's the reason they're still there. So they didn't plan because it was not important to them. It wasn't because they wanted to destroy the Iraqi people. They simply didn't care about them, which is effectively the same thing. Because from the point of view of an Iraqi, it doesn't matter. And the military says, well, it's not our fault if the companies didn't do a good job. From the point of view of the Iraqi, it doesn't matter if Halliburton did a bad job or an Iraqi contractor stole the money and didn't do a good job. They don't have water. And today, by the military's own figures, there's less water, there's less electricity, and there's less sewage treatment in Iraq than there was in the month before the occupation, after 10 years of sanctions. And you can blame a variety of factors. The mismanagement, you can blame the corruption, you can blame the security situation. The fact of the matter is that people in Iraq are pretty upset.
And that's the voice of Pratap Chatterjee, who is the author of Iraq, Inc., the executive director of the website CorpWatch, which publishes lots of great stuff on corporate malfeasance and related topics, corpwatch.org, and who is just in Iraq and back yesterday. He will be at Blue Stockings Bookstore tonight, 7 o'clock, at 172 Allen, between Stanton and Rivington, one block south of the intersection of Houston Street. And again, that's tonight at 7. And let's take a little break, and we'll be back in a little bit to listen to Andrew Ross.
We are so wet, so close, the choir. And you are listening to BAI New York. BAI New York. San Bonani.
And that's a classy station ID. This is WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And let's take a little musical break with this old classic 1948 song to set up Andrew Ross.
On a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. from all the commotion, melting your heart of stone. I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself with nobody else. Yes, all to myself alone.
And that little excerpt from Slow Boat to China, the 1948 hit by Kay Kaiser and his orchestra, and I think that was Ginny Sims doing the vocals. And that is a corny setup for Andrew Ross, who is the author of the book Fast Boat to China, about his year spent in Shanghai. Andrew Ross, also professor of American Studies and chair of Metropolitan Studies at NYU. Andrew Ross. So, Andrew, tell us, first of all, how'd you conceive of this trip, and where'd you go?
I conceived of the trip because for the last several years, perhaps as much as a decade, there's been a lot of agonizing, hand-wringing in this country about job transfers from offshore outsourcing, and a lot of very strong sentiment about that issue. Most of it, I found, was armchair opinion, and there wasn't a lot of research on the ground about what happens to the jobs once they're transferred. And although I've been writing about issues like this for a while, I'd never spent a sustained amount of time in any offshore location, and decided I wanted to do that. And I made a couple of trips to China before, and it turned out that most of the anxiety in the last few years had been about more highly skilled jobs leaving this country, jobs that are much higher up the technology curve. One of the premier destinations for those jobs is mainland China, of course, and especially the Yangtze Delta, which, unlike the South China, which is the sort of export platform zone of choice, the Yangtze Delta cities are increasingly the location where we see the foreign direct investment that's sort of more high value, high skilled, high tech. And so basically that's where I did my research for a year for this book.
And did you get a chance to look at any of the lower tech stuff, garment, low-tech electronics, or is it mainly looking at the IT workers and related enterprises?
I concentrated on the higher value stuff, primarily because, first of all, there's hardly anything that's been written about those sectors. There's a number of good books, actually, about, you know, the sweatshops of South China, mostly books that have come out through Hong Kong or scholars or journalists who are working that beat. But the Yangtze Delta, which is now has now basically outstripped the Pearl River Delta in the south as the leading growth engine in the Chinese economy, the Yangtze Delta is relatively unscrutinized, or was at the time that I decided to go there. And so this research was fairly fresh, just in terms of other people had not been there before me, and in the factories and the offices where I was doing my interviews, I really didn't come across any other, you know, writers or scholars or journalists who were basically in pursuit of the same kinds of information that I was.
I think a lot of Americans hear China and they think 19th century factories and 19th century cities of you know, the sort that Engels wrote about. Did it look that way to you?
And certainly not where I was. I think anyone, you know, any of your listeners who've been to Shanghai, for example, would, I'm sure, be astonished at what they saw there. And if you visited any of the high-tech industrial parks where they're just sort of, you know, miles and miles of gleaming microchip factories, that image, which is, you know, very much one that is sort of outdated or out of sync with reality, would very quickly dispel. There's a remarkable similarity between the workplaces that are offshore there and the ones that are onshore here. This is one of the things that I discovered.
Now, you spent a lot of time talking to both managers and workers, so let's talk about each of those in turn. First, the managers. How did they see what they were up to? And did they feel any kind of guilt at all about taking jobs away from the U.S. and other first world countries?
It's a good question, because that, one of the things I focused on in the book was it's a whole chapter of, about my interviewing in the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, which is a major outpost of the international business community. And since it's very much at the pivot of the world economy, it's a very crucial watering hole for finance and capital investment. And a lot of the interviews I did with, corporate executives and managers who were basically responsible for implementing the job transfers, basically responsible for making sure there was a return on the investments there. The interviews were taking place during a year, this is 2 years ago, when John Kerry was labeling offshoring CEOs as Benedict Arnolds. And a lot of these folks were sort of ducking for cover at the time, even in Shanghai. And so there was a profound kind of ambivalence, this psychology of ambivalence about what they were doing there, whether it was in the so-called national interest, whatever that is these days, or whether they were doing something that was sort of, you know, raising the bar for labor and environmental standards in mainland China.
That phrase came up a lot, right, raising the bar?
Raising the bar was a phrase that that I found was a touchstone for a lot of the American business community there. They had this self-image of just making things better in China in general through their presence. And whereas I think you could say that is a self-image of Americans in many parts of the world, it was particularly so in China. Given the long history of American missionary involvement in China, of course, there's that legacy. But in addition, I think for pragmatic reasons, it helped a lot for the U.S.-China trade lobby to get what they wanted on Capitol Hill if they were able to say that, we're bringing certain political benefits to China that the Washington government cannot do. And therefore, we should be given special attention. So that was part of their lobbying efforts on Capitol Hill, which was a story that I also cover in the book.
And is there any truth to this, or is it just self-serving propaganda?
Well, on the one hand, it wasn't a self-image that was shared by any of the other foreign business communities. It seemed to be fairly unique to the American business community, and, you know, you can interpret that as you like. Most of it was self-serving and undertaken and believed in for pragmatic reasons, I would say. However, you know, by that same token, you ask any of the skilled employees who appear in the pages of my book who they would rather be working for. If you give them the choice of whether they'd be working for an American corporation or a Japanese corporation or a European company or a Korean or a Taiwanese or a Chinese company, the answer would be pretty much in that order. American, European, Japanese, Korean, Taiwanese, and Chinese. They wanted to be on the payroll of American companies because they felt those were the best opportunities, the best pay, the best benefits. That's all very well, I should add. If you're directly on the payroll, however, most Chinese workers who labor for American brands are not directly on the payroll. They're somewhere in the supply chain, working for subsidiaries or even, you know, small family firms at the very bottom of the production chain, where the price pressure is very, very powerful indeed. And that's where the worst abuses in the workplaces obviously take place. So you can be working for an American brand, but not necessarily on payroll, and that's one of the worst positions to be in China.
Now, we tend to think of Chinese labor as very cheap and very docile. That's the image, the cliche around Chinese labor. How true is that from your observation?
It may be true in unskilled sectors. It's more likely to be true in unskilled sectors, of course, where, at least in the private sector export zone, you know, the only real desirable workforce are teenage girls between the age of about 16 and 21. Those are the folks who are sought out for the export factories in the South China trade zones because they are the cheapest, most expendable, most vulnerable, most docile, as you say. The higher up the value chain you go, it's a somewhat different matter. there are labor shortages, which are really quite extreme at this point in mainland China, both higher up the value chain and also actually among unskilled sectors. I guess you can interpret these labor shortages as relating to this image of docile and cheap, because it tends to go against the grain. It tends to rebut this image of the cheap, docile Chinese worker.
Yeah, you know, you hear all these stories of 300 million unemployed people wandering around the country, people camped out on the streets, desperate for work. How can there be a labor shortage under those circumstances?
Well, it's an interesting question, and there's been a lot of debate internally in China about this. There's probably about between 3 and 4 million workers who don't show up for work in the south of China every spring festival holiday, and that's part of the labor shortage in South China.
They just go off on vacation and don't come back?
Well, they go back to their homes in the inland provinces on the farms, and they haven't been coming back for the last 3 years or so. So there's a big labor shortage. Partly the reason for that is that the government has lifted a lot of agricultural taxes. The tax burden on farmers, some of the taxes have been around for thousands of years. They've actually been lifted in the last year and a half or so, primarily to stave off the threat of rural insurgencies, which is a longstanding fear on the part of China's ruling cadres. And as a result, peasants on the farms are more inclined to feel they can eke out a living, hard scrabble as it is, in the hinterlands than go off to staff the sweatshops of South China. So that's one of the reasons. The other is that the Yangtze Delta region, where the pay is better and the conditions are better and there's more observance of rule of law, is attracting more and more migrant workers.
I'm speaking with Andrew Ross, who is a professor of American Studies at NYU and author of Fast Boat to China, Lessons from Shanghai, just out from Pantheon. You have a couple of vignettes of workers you spoke with who, on first glance, look kind of hip and trendy and modern, but on conversation, they turn out to be less so. Tell us about some of those folks.
I think those were the ones who were working in IT services. A lot of the interviews I did in Shanghai itself were in IT services, many of them working, actually, for Indian companies. Indian software companies have all set up shop in Shanghai because they can't cope with the demand in India itself, and they're chasing the China market. So a lot of the employees, they did display a lot of the same kinds of traits that you would find in among IT service workers, perhaps in this country. But they had Chinese characteristics as well. It'd be difficult to summarize them because they were quite individual in their own ways, but there's a very powerful strain of nationalism, for one thing, that I found in all of my interviews. Very little loyalty on the part of these employees to their employers. They didn't expect their bosses to be around for very long, and so they felt justified in returning the disrespect and the disloyalty. But what they were loyal to was, if I could generalize, would be the grander goal of building up China's independence from its servitude to foreign capital and also foreign technologies. And that was the grander goal of weaning China off its reliance and dependence on foreigners. That's a fairly ancient goal, or at least a century and a half in China behind it. But I think that was something these employees in general, and this was perhaps the more conservative side of their character you were referring to.
You said that managers almost, to a person, describe their Chinese workers as competent and intelligent, but very conventional, not likely to think outside the box, as they say. This seemed to be almost universal complaint. You said that they almost thought they read it in the same manual. Yeah, what about that? Where do the bosses get these ideas from?
Probably, from several centuries of Orientalism, I would imagine. There are a lot of stereotypes about the Chinese that these foreign managers bring with them, as indeed all foreigners probably would bring with them. on encountering China and experiencing residence in China. It's not just something that foreign managers exude. But they do come with these stereotypes, and they're fairly ingrained, and they do, to some extent, dictate or determine how relationships are played out with workers in factories and offices. By that same token, the Chinese employees also have stereotypes of what these foreign managers might be and might want. And so the contact zone between them is a very interesting one, you know, from a cultural standpoint, because you do have this clash of stereotypes. My reading of this, and I collected a lot of evidence of this conflict in the workplace, my reading of it had more to do with how the rules of work were being bargained over in these workplaces. It's a fairly novel workplace environment. So what employees are willing to give and what employers actually want, these things are still being worked out. The rules of play haven't yet been settled. And it could be said that the outcome of that negotiation, that kind of bargaining, if you like, over the rules of the workplace, potentially affect all of us, because these workplaces and the investment in China right now is so pivotal to the future of all of our livelihoods.
Shanghai itself is interesting. You recount some of the history of it. It was, before the revolution, a very rich, internationalized city, corrupt, full of sex and other temptations. And then after the revolution, it was dismantled to some degree. And now it's come back. What about that history of Shanghai? Is it going back to its old glory days?
There's certainly some people who would want that, and there's an extraordinary nostalgia industry which you find in full steam in Shanghai if you look for it. And the spoiling life of the affluent is certainly available once again, and not just for expatriates, but also for the nouveau riche in China, the new tycoons. And they're visible everywhere on the streets or in their shiny cars. The big difference, of course, is that is the very powerful hand of the state, which if you're fairly innocent as a visitor, you can pretty much feel that it is invisible, that this is a sort of thriving capitalist city, or even a capitalist Shangri-La, since a lot of the business side of things is designed to appeal to that image. But if you delve a little deeper, you know, you come across some sort of bedrock realities, which are the state still owns all of the land, and things like the very hot Shanghai real estate market, for example, is based entirely on this short-term belief that there'll be some resolution of the fact that the state owns all of the land and is just giving leases for 70 years or so. No one has asked what's going to happen at the end of that 70 years. And the state plays, obviously, a very central role in a lot of the decision-making in every aspect of life. Not always visible, but certainly there. And so that would probably be the biggest difference, I would imagine, between pre-liberation Shanghai and the current scenario there.
I spoke with an English artist, who had just been on an extended visit to China a couple of years ago. And his impression was that everyone in that society, at all levels, is on the make. Did that strike you that way?
If they can be so, yes. On the one hand, you can hardly blame them, given the history of modern China, both pre-liberation, during Maoism, during the Cultural Revolution, and especially in Shanghai, when Shanghai was very deliberately retarded in terms of its economic growth during the Maoist period, partly as a form of punishment for its parasitical past, and also partly out of fear that it would rise up to rival Beijing and the power brokers in Beijing. When the green light was given relatively late in China's reform era for Shanghai to sprint ahead, as it were, those suppressed entrepreneurial instincts of the populace were liberated, so to speak. But not everyone is in a position, of course, to be on the make. And probably the most invisible parts of the population are, and this is a massive part of the population, are all of the workers who've been laid off from the state sector in the last 10 years or so. Tens of millions of workers, many more workers than have lost their jobs in this country as a result of neoliberal privatization. But they lost their jobs for pretty much the same reasons. They don't show up in the unemployment rolls because they're sort of kept somewhat on the payroll. They're given a monthly stipend, which is a kind of subsistence stipend from the state enterprises. So they don't appear in the unemployment rolls, but they're virtually unemployable. They'll never be employed back by those companies, and no other company will take them on because they're tainted. They're seen as sort of contaminated, incapable of being retrained for the more punishing work ethic of capitalist labor discipline. And there are many, many millions of people in that category, and you don't necessarily see a lot of them because they've been pushed to the margins of cities like Shanghai.
What about the ideological environment? In many ways, you see these slogans coming from the government, which seem almost Maoist in style, if not in content. Mao is still revered. I understand now that the leadership is studying Marxist-Leninist Maoist thought with a renewed intensity. There's a story in the Times the other day about all the Chinese who visit Marx's birthplace on their trips to Trier. Yet at the same time, you know, this seems like a very hyper-capitalist environment. So how do all these things get along with each other?
Well, it's an interesting question because Mao is certainly still revered, you know, mostly by older generations. He's also officially revered by the current rulers of China as having been, you know, 70% right and 30% wrong, which I believe was something that he himself said about Stalin, and so justifies the current rulers of China saying it about him. His writings are combed for tips about for managerial tips. There's a two volume edition of Mao's writings that have been put together by a central government office that contain tips for business management. So there's all sorts of ways in which Mao is used and revered. But as far as policy making goes, I think the Tiananmen Square was a kind of crucial turning point for national ideological indoctrination campaigns, if I could put it that way. Up until that point, Maoist, Marxist, Leninist doctrine had been at the cornerstone of these national campaigns. Ever since then, there's been a sort of switch towards patriotic education, and that's one of the reasons why Chinese nationalism is so passionate and fierce, because it's so much the object of these national education campaigns.
And finally, what about the ideology on this side of the ocean? A lot of the discourse around China draws upon more than a century of American xenophobia about the yellow peril. And it's not just the right that does that. You hear, you know, union people and fair trade people say things that make my skin crawl a lot of the times. But there's all this rhetoric about the Chinese stealing our jobs and China as a threat. How do you handle that? I mean, what would you say to people who are trying to confront this very substantial challenge that China represents without doing it in a kind of nationalist or ugly way?
Yeah, I think that's the question that really lies at the core of my book, because there has been a renewal of a lot of that yellow peril-like invocations of the China threat in recent years or so. It remains the fact that China is the indispensable enemy. This is the title of Alexander Saxton's wonderful book about the Chinese in California in the 19th century. They're always the ones who are blamed for taking our jobs, quote unquote. And it's no longer, you know, in California domestically, it's on the mainland of China now. And it's true, as you say, that sentiment is still alive and well in some sectors of the labor movement. As a result, this is the only country, the only industrialized country in the world whose national labor movement doesn't have official ties with the Chinese Trade Union Federation. And whichever, whatever you think about that, it's not a situation that that augurs very well. It's not doing anyone any good at this point in time for trade unions in this country and trade unions in China to have no official channels of communication. As a result, it's sort of fallen to you know, sort of labor scholars like myself or investigative reporters to do the kind of research that would otherwise be a little more available if we had good trade union ties and had more of an exchange of information between the two labor movements in either country. Just to conclude, I would say that you know, one of the gut instincts in this country has been protectionist and over offshore outsourcing. And personally, I don't feel that there's anything wrong with that, with protectionism per se. But it does sometimes bring out the ugly side of economic nationalism, the xenophobic side. And we always have to remember that there are alternatives to corporate globalization. There have to be alternatives. And, you know, they come in the form of fair trade, not free trade. They come in the form of sustainable development. And they come in the form of equitable, socially conscious forms of investing rather than in short-term profit and plunder.
And that's the voice of Andrew Ross, professor of American Studies at New York University, chairman of the Metropolitan Studies Department there, and author, most recently, of the book Fast Boat to China, Corporate Flight and the Consequences of Free Trade, Lessons from Shanghai, just published by Pantheon. And just to repeat some of the announcements from the beginning of the show, remember tomorrow the Speak Out Against the Iraq War, sponsored by Iraq Veterans Against the War, at the Community Church, 40 East 35th Street, between Madison and Park in Manhattan, 5 to 7 p.m. tomorrow evening. Kathleen Cleaver, speaking, former Communications Secretary of the Black Panther Party, speaking at Brooklyn College, Thursday, May 4th, 4:30, speaking about Behind the Myths, Rosa Parks and America's Struggle for Human Rights, Bedford Lounge of the Brooklyn College Student Center, Campus Road at East 27th Street. And then finally, my first guest, Pratap Chatterjee, will be reading at Blue Stockings tonight, the bookstore, which is always worth a visit. And you can hear Pratap, who we heard from earlier in the show. That's 172 Allen Street between Stanton and Rivington, one block south of the intersection of Houston Street and First Avenue. That's at 7 p.m. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with another version of Slow Boat to China, this by Sonny Rollins and the Modern Jazz Quartet from 1951.